From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, in for Marty Moscowane. A months-long investigation into how state governments are doing in providing transparency and accountability and staving off corruption is being unveiled today. The results are troubling and a bit surprising. The State Integrity Investigation is a collaboration of the Center for Public Integrity, Public Radio International, and Global Integrity, and it paints a picture of state houses ripe for corruption and self-dealing. Instead of just ripping from the headlines, though, the State Integrity Index measures the risk of corruption. Well, this hour, we take a look at the report and specifically at the scores for Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware. You might be surprised at the results. Joining us are three Delaware Valley journalists who conducted the investigation. We'll be talking with Peter Durantine, who covered Pennsylvania state government for 15 years for the Associated Press, Philadelphia Daily News, and the York Daily Record. Colleen O'Day will join us from New Jersey, where she's an editor-at-large for NJ Spotlight and longtime investigative reporter for the Daily Record of Morris County, New Jersey. And first up is Chris Barish. Chris is senior reporter for the News Journal of Delaware. He's been there for many years. He has won numerous awards for his coverage there, regionally and nationally. Co-author of Fatal Embrace, about the investigation into the murder of gubernatorial secretary Anne Marie Fahey, and his coverage of Delaware pediatrician and child molester Earl Bradley won 4 national awards. Chris, welcome to Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Tracy.
Well, let me just say to our listeners first that if you live in Delaware and you've got a question for Chris about this report, we want to give you the number so that you can call in, because we'll only have Chris with us for the first segment of the program. The number is 888-477-9499. We're talking about integrity in state government. Chris, tell us, first of all, what was the impetus for even doing this study?
Well, the State Integrity Project was run by the Center for Public Integrity in Washington, and what they did was they hired a journalist in every state to conduct the research into 330 questions based on the laws and practices of each state. And they reached out to me. Delaware's a small state, and there's not a ton of media here, and I work at the biggest paper in the state, and they reached out to me, and my editors allowed me to do it on a freelance basis, and did it in my spare time, and here we are.
So let's get right to it, Chris. How did Delaware do overall?
We got a C-, which is what I'm calling depressingly and distressingly average. We finished 22nd in the nation for overall transparency. We had some poor marks in freedom of information, lobbying, some other categories. Did okay in auditing and budgeting. Lobbying is an issue I've written about extensively over the last 5 years, and despite promises and hopes to change the disclosure rules and open up the process a little more, nothing's happened. The Governor Jack Markell is promising this year, and legislative leaders are promising to get some reform this year, but we'll see, because it's been 5 years since we exposed some really big gaps in what's done and what's reported, and nothing has changed.
Well, that really was a big area, as I read through what you wrote about it, that the influence of lobbyists there and also the lack of regulations for them.
Well, it's, you know, if you go down the legislative hall in Dover, it's sort of this magical world where reality fades away. But you'll see legislators who served with, you know, in powerful positions for 10, 20, 30 years, they leave office and they come back and they're lobbying for either the Delaware Healthcare Association or one of their casinos or one of the big corporations, and they walk around like they're still a legislator. And, you know, they're all polite and very nice to everybody, but it's just it's hard to tell which hat someone's wearing when they've been in the legislature a long time. Now, one of the stories I wrote 5 years ago detailed how the Speaker of the House, Terry Spence, received the most unidentifiable gifts from lobbyists, and he lost the next year. But what lobbyists have always done is spent money in, like, groups that allow them to escape the threshold of reporting. If it's over $50 a person, in a day, they have to report who received the gift. But they figure out a way that it might be $48 for 40 people, including legislators, and they don't get identified. Yeah. And when Spence did get identified, he lost in the next election.
You write about the Delaware way, Chris. What's that?
Well, politicians and insiders like to say that the Delaware way is, members of both parties, leaders of both parties, rolling up their sleeves, getting things done, maybe being behind a closed door, but working it out for the betterment of everybody. But more and more, I've always thought it was just a way to keep the public out of the process and keep the decisions in the hands of a few people who've designated themselves as the experts in any issue. Mm-hmm. Well, and often it's the newspapers reporting that, breaks people out of their lethargy and wakes them up. When I did the lobbying report, one of the things I never got to, but lobbyists had told me, was that there were people lobbying that hadn't registered as lobbyists. And I spent more time studying the database of lobbying and learning, who was spending what, who were they identifying, who they weren't. But then last year it came out through some other reporting the paper did that a liquor industry executive was actually acting as a lobbyist but had never reported it. Took the governor on plane trips, and it turned out that this guy Chris Tigani just got sentenced to 2 years in prison for federal campaign violations for bundling donations to Vice President Biden and others. So that was sort of the underbelly of lobbying that I couldn't even scratch then, because I couldn't get any proof of it. But the rules are pretty weak in general, but then people don't even follow them.
Yeah. Well, Chris, you mentioned databases, and that certainly has been an Achilles heel for reporters like yourself. Just getting access to records, and so often, reporters are told, we're inundated with these kinds of requests. Is that the case, and how difficult is it to, first of all, get access to, some of these numbers through the agencies that are responsible to provide them?
Well, just FOIA in general, it just has so many exemptions in Delaware that it's just, sometimes it's abominable.
And when you say FOIA, you're talking about Freedom of Information.
Correct? I'm sorry. Uh-huh. And it's just abominable. But when we get a lot of information and we get databases, one of the things we routinely get is the salaries for all state employees. And legislators somehow exempted themselves from that. We persuaded them to release it, but one of the things it always has is the salaries for the state police. Now, last week, our paper wrote how the city police in Wilmington do not want to release their officer salaries based on the police officer's Bill of Rights. And there's a big battle going on right now of having just knowing how much your neighbor who might be a city police officer makes in overtime, because they're trying not to identify that. So we run into battles like that all the time. Now, with the lobbying, we knew, you can look up individual records of each lobbyist, what they do, but we wanted to look at it on a comprehensive basis. So we found out there was a database, and we assumed there was a database because it looks like it's in data form, and we tried to get it, and the people that run the Ethics Enforcement Agency, the Public Integrity Center for Delaware, they wouldn't give it to us. Because they said we could come look at it, and that's enough. So we had to go to the state attorney general's office, get them to order the Public Integrity Commission to release it to us. And then we spent a few months, filtering it out and trying to decide, what was the most important things to put out. We ended up creating an online database with, all the lobbyists and all the people they gave money to. And it really helped expose what was going on and how we couldn't find out everything that was going on.
Yeah.
It was a real battle to get that. It took, it was a 6-month endeavor to get the database, cull through it and finally print our findings. And we thought there was going to be a lot of change after that, and there were promises of changes, but nothing changed legislatively. And what happened more than anything was the legislators even went more underground and ended up having more group dinners and group cocktail parties where they didn't have to identify the legislator because it was damaging to them.
And you mentioned that Public Integrity Commission. There's a problem there, it sounds like, just because it's woefully understaffed, a very small budget. Does that play into some of the frustration that you experienced?
Well, the woman who runs it, Janet Wright, she's an attorney, and she really works her butt off. But they're just overwhelmed. They get so many complaints, and they have so many, beyond the state government, they have a lot of local governments to oversee, and they just don't have the manpower to really investigate. They have a commission that all they do is rule on the Janet Wright and her assistants' work. And it's almost, you know, I mean, if you really don't want scrutiny of what you're doing, you staff an office with a couple people rather than, you know, 10 people like maybe it needs.
Yeah. Well, and Chris, as I read through, you know, your report, I was struck by the difficulty of changing the status quo when the people who are in a position to change it are often the beneficiaries of the status quo.
That's the truth. The legislators are really entrenched, and, you know, a lot of them, the majority of them run without any opposition, and they sort of think they're their own fiefdoms, and they, you know, they're really resistant to change here. You know, now, Governor Markell has been a little more reform-minded than Ruth Ann Minner, the previous governor, was, and he's methodically made some changes to the FOIA law, called for standardized forms, standardized costs, because you could call one state agency and they'll tell you 50 cents a page, another will tell you $1 a page, another will take a month to get information, another will give it to you, you know, in a matter of 3 seconds. So he's trying to standardize a lot of the practices.
Chris, what can we learn from this report about Delaware in particular, maybe the tri-state area in general?
I don't understand New Jersey, how it was the best, but that the New Jersey reporters can talk about that.
We'll be talking about that in a moment for sure.
A lot more needs to be done, and the people need to really press legislators to be more transparent, and the governor's office and state agencies to be more transparent in how they conduct business, because all it does is cause distrust. I mean, when I'm trying to get information and I can't get it, and the first thing I see is, what are they trying to hide?
Yeah.
Well, sometimes they're not trying to hide anything, they shackle themselves with these FOIA exemptions. And I try to explain to a lot of these agencies, just because it's an exemption doesn't mean you can't release it. It means you don't have to release it by law, but you're always free to release it. And then they'll hide behind their attorney general, who gives them advice. So what can you learn? Delaware needs to be a lot more open.
Chris, in 15 seconds or less, what is your hope for what will come out of the work that you've done on this report?
Well, I'd really like to, I think a lot of people would really like to see some lobbying reform this year and just continued openness and, have the government follow the FOIA, the new changes to the open records laws, and just increase transparency so the public can benefit and know what's going on.
Well, Chris Barish, thank you so much for being with us from the News Journal of Delaware. We appreciate your insight. We are talking about state government and the levels of integrity there, based on a report that is being released today. Next up, we'll be talking about New Jersey. If you live in New Jersey, you've got questions about what's going on there, we'd invite you to call in at 888-477-9499. We're talking with Colleen O'Day next on Radio Times.
Bringing together artists and patrons for 18 years, the Philadelphia Invitational Furniture Show supports WHYY. This year, the show moves downtown to the 23rd Street Armory on 23rd just south of Market and runs from Friday evening, March 23rd to Sunday the 25th. Featuring modern and traditional tables, chairs, beds, desks, lighting, and tabletop items. For more info, philaifs.com. The Philadelphia Invitational Furniture Show. Invest in beauty.
Next time on Tell Me More, we take you behind closed doors to talk about a health crisis in the Navajo Nation.
We don't think it's here and it'll never get here. He says, if you're talking about it, you're wishing it on the people.
We'll find out how members of one of the country's largest tribes are trying to face up to HIV and AIDS. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Abington Health supports WHYY. Their Orthopedic and Spine Institute is performing a procedure called anterior hip replacement. Using a mini incision and specifically designed surgical table, surgeons at Abington and Lansdale Hospitals are able to replace the hip joint through the front rather than the side, sparing muscles. The hospital stay and the recovery time are shorter, enabling patients to return more quickly to regular activities, like driving. More at abingtonhealth.org/bone.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moskowain. We're talking about corruption at the state level and the risk of it as measured by the State Integrity Investigation. It's a months-long look at how states are doing in providing transparency and accountability and warding off corruption. Well, we're zeroing in on scores for the tri-state area with the help of the journalists who conducted the investigation. And we turn now to the Garden State and Colleen O'Day, an editor-at-large for NJ Spotlight and longtime investigator for the Daily Record of Morris County. Colleen, welcome to Radio Times.
Hi, Tracy. Thanks for having me.
Well, we're so glad that you're here, and we want to give our listeners the number to call in. If you live in Jersey, you've got some questions about what's going on in state government. The number is 888-477-9499. Colleen, as you know, we just finished talking with Chris Barish from the News Journal about Delaware, which got a grade of a C-. How did New Jersey do?
Well, New Jersey got a B+, but shockingly, it finished number one in the nation. And I can tell you, I don't think anyone was more surprised than I was about that, having lived in New Jersey my whole life.
Well, there's been a headline or two about corruption in the state of New Jersey over the years, huh?
Just a couple, I'd say. Yeah, maybe a couple a day is what it seems like sometimes.
Well, so how do you account then for such a good grade in light of, the issues that have plagued New Jersey over the years?
So the interesting thing about the project is that it was not actually measuring the amount of corruption, but it was trying to measure laws that exist to either prevent or deal with those then who run afoul of the laws, and also how those laws are followed and enforced. So what we found happened in New Jersey is because we've had so many instances of public officials at the local level, state level, doing these kinds of backroom deals to pay developers paying to get their projects approved or no-show jobs. The state legislature has acted, as well as the governors, and has put in place a lot of laws to kind of deal with corruption. So we do have a lot of the laws on the books that try to, at least, again, if not prevent corruption, then deal with it when it does occur.
So it sounds like, Colleen, that the sheer number of problems that a state like New Jersey faced actually was helpful in terms of creating these laws and putting it in a much better position now.
That's absolutely true. There have been, it happens, I think, all over the place when we see it at the federal level and we see it at the state level. When something happens, that's what triggers legislators, lawmakers to say, okay, we need to make a change here, and then legislation goes into place. That's exactly what's happened in New Jersey.
And a B+ certainly is not a bad grade by any standards, but it does leave some room for improvement. What were some of the problem areas that remain?
It actually leaves a lot of room for improvement. We actually have a great election commission, the Election Law Enforcement Commission, that does a yeoman's work in terms of trying to keep track of political fundraising, expenditures. It also enforces our lobbying laws. But there's more work that we need to do in terms of those laws. For instance, two things we don't deal with are called bundling and wheeling. Bundling is when you can have you can maximize your contribution by having your wife, your children, your brothers, your uncles all make contributions to the same candidate. That's one way to get around the campaign caps, the caps mm-hmm. for donations. Wheeling is when different county committees or the state committee give money to one another so that if there's a challenge in, let's say, Camden County, suddenly all of the Democratic committees in the state can funnel money to Camden County, and then the Camden County committee has suddenly $1 million instead of $100,000. So those are things we don't deal with. We also really need, and the state officials at ELEC want to regulate the 501c4s, those issue advocacy groups, things like super PACs in New Jersey, because like at the federal level today, they can report, they can get contributions and also make expenditures without having to report what they're doing.
Yeah. And that brings up the point of access. And let me just say at this point that WHYY is a partner in this project. If you're interested in going into more detail about the findings, you can find them on newsworks.org. We're talking with Colleen O'Day, an editor-at-large for NJ Spotlight. And Colleen, certainly, you brought up access to records and sort of getting around some of these laws and creating loopholes, that sort of thing. Talk about the Open Records Act and how well it works from your perspective as a reporter.
Well, you know, our Open Records Act now, which we call OPRA, is 10 years old, and while it was much, much better than what had been in place before, it still has a long way to go because of all of the varying positions, the different people who were involved who were fighting over it. There are 49 exemptions, which is an awful lot. So there are still a lot of things that you can't get access to in New Jersey. Another problem that we have is when you are denied, so the law specifies that if you put in a request for a public record, you get 7 days to the person you're requesting it of has 7 days to give it to you. If within that time period they say, sorry, we you're not entitled to this, often you get a vague answer, and then you have a choice. You can go to court and pay to try to get these records, or if you want to do it the freeway, which, the average citizen is going to want to do, you go to the Government Records Council, which was set up to deal with this. The problem at the Government Records Council is they've been taking about 18 months to hear these issues, and, that's a long time to wait, and by the time you get the document, if you get it then, the issue is probably long since passed.
You may not need it at that point.
No,
right?
You probably don't. That's true.
Colleen, I bet you could write a book about some of your experiences with trying to, get to the bottom of information and get the kinds of things that you need in a timely manner.
Yeah, it can be very difficult. There's a couple things that we've done lately, actually, that we had some issues with. I'm sure your listeners are familiar with the Rutgers Rowan controversy happening in South Jersey, where there's been a proposal that Rutgers Camden be merged into Rowan University. Folks were asking how this happened, and we put in a public records request to the governor's office to try to get the background documents because there was a report that came out, and we were told that there were no such documents. And that was kind of odd, but it turns out that the commission that made this recommendation, because it's considered a gubernatorial advisory commission, was not required to provide any background documents. So there you go. What happened? I'm also in the process moving with state government to try to get some records, and they're in one office. They have to be transferred to another, so I've gotten several requests for, can you please give me more time, and the request has been ongoing for probably 2 months now, and I'm still waiting.
Well, let's go to the phones while we have you with us, Colleen. We'll go to East Brunswick and bring Nona in on our conversation. Hi, welcome to Radio Times.
Yes, hello.
Your comment or question for Colleen.
Yes, I would just like to thank her for her efforts in bringing some light to state government. My comment has to do with the Office of Public Guardian. I happen to have a neighbor who is 90 years old whose life has been taken over by the Office of Public Guardian. But I understand that there are 1,500 seniors who are now under the control of the Office of Public Guardian. And in the case of my neighbor, her financial assets range between $3 and $4 million. So obviously that 1,500 seniors means that the state could well have acquired quite a lot of a way of bringing funds into the state coffers by taking over control of those people's lives. And in my neighbor's case, there has been a significant withdrawal of medical care. She's not allowed to see her own physicians, not allowed to have a physical or test to assess the drugs, the impact of the drugs that are being prescribed to her. So I think this is an area of very useful future research from Zoday.
Thanks for your call.
Colleen? Yeah, wow. Thank you for that. You know, that's not one of the areas that our study looked at, but wow, you just gave me a great idea for something to look at. That's certainly, when you consider the Office of the Public Guardian, it sounds like it should be a good office, but it sounds, Nona, that maybe that's not what's happening here.
Yeah. You write, Colleen, about phantom advocates, you know, not disclosing their contributors but giving large amounts to certain candidates. Why are special interest groups not required to disclose contributors? Is there any change likely in that regard?
So officials in New Jersey, at least at the Election Law Enforcement Commission, are looking at that. There is State Senator Loretta Weinberg, who actually also has bills in to beef up our Open Records and Open Public Meetings Acts, she's got legislation in to do that. It is one of those things that originally had kind of gone under the radar because these groups had not been really active. They hadn't even existed in New Jersey a few years ago, and it's just within the last couple years. There was a pro-Christie group that formed, then there was, in response, a pro-Democrat group that formed. So it's kind of more of a recent thing, and, you know, it's kind of, as we talked about in the beginning, it's not until there's some real abuse and the issue gets real bright public light on it that legislators are often willing to make those kind of changes. Because, you know, again, if this group is supporting, let's say, the Democratic Party, well, why would the Democrats, who, you know, now are in power in both houses of the legislature, they don't really have a great impetus for regulating them.
Yeah. One of the big problems that we talked about in Delaware just a few minutes ago, Colleen, relates to lobbying, and I know that you mentioned that briefly. It's a concern in Delaware, I think in Pennsylvania as well. Is it a big concern in Jersey?
Well, we actually have some pretty good lobbying laws as well here. So, in fact, this year, the Election Law Enforcement Commission report, they do reports every year as they track spending, determined that the smallest amount of benefit passing occurred this year. And what that is when lobbyists pay for a legislator to, let's say, take the Chamber of Commerce train trip down to D.C. We have this crazy train trip every year down to Washington, and it used to be one of those things where every legislator would take this train down, and you know, it's a couple days. There's a nice hotel that you stay in. There are all sorts of parties. There's food. So lobbyists would often pay for legislators to go down. Well, as more and more reporters wrote about that, the public started to say, hey, that's not right, because this is a private access. While these legislators are on the train with the lobbyists for 3 hours, they've got exclusive access to those people, and they can, you know, talk to them and try to convince them to push their bills. There were worse examples. Some lobbying groups would pay to fly legislators down as far away as Hawaii to their conferences to speak, and wow, what a nice trip that was. Well, because of New Jersey required more and more disclosure about that, and because reporters wrote more and more about it, there was a public outcry. And this year, it was the smallest amount of that benefit passing happening. So that's been a very good thing in terms of integrity in New Jersey.
Colleen, you talked about how, you know, it took a number of problems surfacing, you know, for these laws to be put into place. Was there a specific turning point, do you think, in New Jersey, a specific incident or situation that really led to, you know, the beginning of the implementation of some of these laws, or a specific time frame?
Depending on the area that we're looking at, there have been different time frames. So our original campaign finance laws kind of came into place in the 90s. We had more pay-to-play laws coming into place in, we haven't talked about that yet, in 2004. And we had a number of issues that kind of brought that to light. We had a whole string of issues involving state spending projects. So we privatized the motor vehicle inspection program. We also brought in an outside contractor, and it turned out that, you know, again, there was a question of people who had made who were politically connected. We also had we were trying to put in a toll road payment system. We had state school construction issues. So we had a whole host of issues, and there were many stories also that were written about folks who were making political contributions and were then getting contracts, state yeah. contracts. So that's when our pay-to-play laws went in place. And our pay-to-play law, at least at the state level, is considered the toughest in the nation. And essentially, if you make a political contribution, you cannot get a state contract. You know, that's it. Mm. The only area, ironically, where that is not the case is in the case of federal highway funding, and that's because of the federal rule. The federal rules do not allow us to put use our pay-to-play law over their funding. So, kind of an odd thing.
Yeah. What's been the impact of Governor Christie on all this? Can he take some credit for some of these reforms, or is there an impact that he's made?
Well, Governor Christie came in, as the U.S. attorney, he was very strong. He was known for prosecuting more than 100 New Jersey public officials, most of them at the lower levels, at the municipal level, but there were a couple of state officials as well. But, you know, his problem is that he is the Republican governor with a Democratic legislature at the moment. So he came in and he put forth a fairly ambitious plan to try to put in some reforms. No dual office holding that ends any grandfathering, which right now, we do have a dual office holding ban, but if you were in office before that ban took effect, you can keep your job, you know, until you leave or until you die. He wants to improve financial disclosure forms for the legislative branch, which is really, really, those are pretty weak right now. He's got a whole host of reforms he wants to put into place, but so far nothing's gone through. And, you know, part of that is because of the back and forth that we have between Christie and the legislature. Mm-hmm. So Christie, in fact, tried to impose on the legislature through a conditional veto of a bill, these tougher financial disclosure requirements for legislators. And when he CV'd their bill, they just ignored it. So the status quo remains in effect. Yeah.
Colleen O'Day, thank you so much for being with us, for the work that you have done on this project. So interesting to see that New Jersey ranked number one on the state integrity investigation. We appreciate you being with us.
Thanks again, Tracy.
And in the last 20 minutes of the show, we want to hear from Pennsylvania listeners. We'll be talking about PA next, 888-477-9499. WHYY is a partner in this project. You can get more detailed findings at newsworks.org, and Radio Times will be right back.
The Philadelphia Foundation supports WHYY. Since 1918, the Philadelphia Foundation has built healthy communities. It supports nonprofit organizations that strengthen neighborhoods, broaden access to services, promote health, and sustain basic human needs. The Foundation can help you make a difference for such southeastern Pennsylvania nonprofits today and forever, while you receive tax deductions. The Philadelphia Foundation, 215-563-6417 or philofound.org.
In the new book, The Undead, science writer Dick Teresi examines how advanced medical technology is blurring the line between life and death. One example relates to the process of organ donation. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Teresi and with organ transplant surgeon Dr. Richard Freeman. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
In the new book, The Undead, science writer Dick Teresi examines how advanced medical technology is blurring the line between life and death. One example relates to the process of organ donation. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Teresi and with organ transplant surgeon Dr. Richard Freeman. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, in for Marty Moskowain. A recent survey by the Edelman Trust Barometer shows that public trust in government officials has plummeted to 29% in the past year alone, and that's a 20% drop from the year before. So that makes the state integrity investigation released this morning all the more timely. It's a report card for each of the 50 states that measures things like commitment to integrity and risk of corruption. Here in the tri-state area, the results were mixed. Delaware scored a C- overall, while New Jersey got a B+ and ranked number one. We turn now to Pennsylvania and Peter Durantine, one of the journalists who conducted the investigation. Peter is editor of The Berg, Harrisburg's monthly community newspaper, and has covered the state capitol for 15 years for the Associated Press, the Philadelphia Daily News, and the York Daily Record. Peter, welcome to Radio Times.
Hi, thanks, Tracy.
And if you live in Pennsylvania, if you've got some questions for Peter in the last 20 minutes of our program, we invite you to call us at 888-477-9499. So, Peter, how did we do in Pennsylvania?
Well, C-. We ranked 19th among the 50 states, and I have to tell you, in my work here, I wasn't surprised with much of what I found. I was surprised. The thing that was the open records law, the creation of an open records office, but then not too surprised to see that the office does not. They work very hard there, but they don't have all the resources they need. They don't have any enforcement power to demand the agencies release records that they that are deemed open.
That seems to be a problem across the tri-state area, perhaps a little bit less in Jersey, but lack of disclosure in general is a problem in Pennsylvania. And you write about what you call a culture of intolerance to openness that seems to prevail. Can you give us some examples of that that you've experienced?
The funniest thing was, I think it was two things are kind of comical in a sense. The state pension board. I wanted to know. I called them up and I wanted to know what their if they had a code of ethics, and they said we do. And I said, well, you know, what is it? They said, well, we have a code of ethics. I said, well, shouldn't you have it on the website? Shouldn't you make it really available for people? It's not on your website. And they said, well, that's a good idea. We'll think about it. The next day it was up on our website. And my thought was, when they did that, was, well, why just didn't you have it up in the first place? And then when I went to read the Code of Ethics, it was, you know, straightforward, and they were going to follow. And I don't think SERS, the State Employee Retirement Board, I think it's a well-working organization. And their code of ethics was fine, but there was almost a tone in the code about, like, look, we're not going to do anything wrong here, but we're going to state our code of ethics and let you know that we are following these ethic rules, but, you know, be mindful that we're not going to be doing anything wrong. And I don't think they get it. I mean, I don't think people understand that people want to assume that they're going to do everything right. Nonetheless, there needs to be some type of rules and regulations to at least ensure public confidence that they're, you know, adhering to a code of ethics.
Yeah, so it sounds like it was not that we even need to say this, but
right,
sort
exactly.
of a thing, yeah.
And the other one was kind of interesting was the Attorney General's office. Now, with all the cases of public corruption that have come to light and of all the convictions, I went to the website looking for the public corruption unit, and I couldn't find anything. I did find a press release dating back a few years, where then Attorney General Corbett announced that, you know, as Attorney General, he was creating a public corruption unit, and they were going to be, you know, cracking down on corruption. And then I asked about it. I said I was trying to find it on the site, couldn't find it anywhere. They directed me to the criminal law site, and I went there, and I still couldn't find it.
Wow.
but I'm sure if I called them, they would finally direct me to it or what have you. But, and again, you know, my research on this, and I told this to the Center for Public Integrity, after doing all this research, going through these 330 indicators, I came to the conclusion that it shouldn't be this difficult. We shouldn't even be having a project to be investigating whether how transparent the government is. It's just, why is it that difficult to be transparent? It's really not rocket science, and I don't understand, especially with technology today, because it used to be, before the Internet, when I was working up there, we'd ask for, we have to have a staff, we have to take a staff person away from other duties to go get this public record that you want, we don't know what you want to use it for, and okay, well now you can have it all on the Internet, and all you have to do is go to it. I don't even have to ask any staffer to put it on, to go for it. And so I still am befuddled why there's two things. Why they just don't put it up and make it as available as possible. Why their websites, some of them are good. Some of those states' websites are very accessible, very good. Others are lacking. They need to be upgraded to some extent. The State Ethics Commission, I think they work hard over there. They do the best job they can, but clearly they seem to be underfunded, understaffed, and their website could be a hell of a lot better than it is. I mean, I don't understand why the ethic reports and the State Ethics Commission aren't broken down to, lawmakers' ethics statements, the governor and cabinet. Instead, it's alphabetical order, and it's a very cumbersome process to go through. The Office of Open Records, I mean, their biggest concern is that they will tell an agency, okay, well, this, the law that they passed a couple of years ago stated that the burden of proof was on the government, which was a big change, a very, very significant change in Pennsylvania government. Therefore, if someone came to the government and said, I want an open record, the government was going to have to prove that it was a closed record. Mm-hmm. And the problem, though, is that the person, somebody goes and wants an open record, the agency says, no, it's closed. The Office of Open Records investigates and says, no, you're wrong, it's open. And that's where it ends, because they can't force them to do anything. They have no enforcement power. Now, the person who wants an open record, if they had the resources and the will and the desire, they can then go to court and fight this out in court. But, I mean, who has, the power and the resources to do that all the time? And it's just, I find it striking that they've given, this, they've created this office, and it's for, with the public in mind, yet it's like basically Goldilocks against the Three Bears. You're trying to get somebody who's trying to do their best, and you've got this powerful organization, the government, with all these resources to deny records to people.
Yeah.
And the most interesting thing I found in that is that the people running the Office of Open Records tell me that the lawyers at all the agencies are automatically just say no. So it's just an automatic.
Wow.
And they don't understand why they think a lot of the officials in government want to do the right thing, want to release this information, but their claim is that the lawyers are saying no.
Along those lines, let's open the phones. We'll go to Northeast Philly, and we'll bring Joe in on our conversation. Hi, Joe. Welcome to Radio Times.
Hi. My question concerns the state areas on aging, the different offices that deal with aging. And when they do an assessment of an individual, an aged person, the aged person themselves can't even get the information about themselves. I don't understand why.
Well, that's a good question, and that's a question I had. Our investigation didn't get into to departments like the Office of Aging, but I mean that's kind of an example, though, what goes on throughout government when seeking information. Why is it difficult? Do they give you an answer why they can't give you this information?
They said it's the law. They can't do it.
They can't give you your own information.
Right. They said it's the law. For example, a psychiatric report. I called the doctor up, and they said, well, it's the law. I can't give it to you. What law? What law?
Well, it sounds like that points up exactly what you were talking about, Peter, just the difficulty of access to things that you would think would be pretty easy to get your hands on.
Yeah, that's always been, and that's a mystery to me. It was a mystery when I worked in the legislature, when I worked on Capitol Hill and covered the legislature, why Why is there a problem with releasing this information? And most of this information, the funniest thing is, I think 99% of this information that they're blocking is nothing damning in it. I don't think there's anything that's going to shake up anybody. I think it's just basic information.
Mm. Well, Pete, let's talk about the judiciary, because you said that that may be one of the most difficult areas to deal with. And certainly when we think of that, we think about the Cash for Kids scandal in Luzerne County, that sort of thing. Tell us about that. Has that scandal changed anything in terms of, you know, creating more openness, or what are things like in dealing with the judiciary at this point?
Well, from my research, no, it doesn't seem to have done anything. I mean, the court back in 2000 decided that it was going to take care of itself. That it's the State Ethics Commission has no jurisdiction over the courts, and the court said we're going to handle our own. You know, we're going to take care of our own people here in matters of discipline. There seems to be, or at least from my research, there seems to be a need for something, an independent agency to oversee what's going on in the courts. Some critics have said, and I was in reading over all the news reports and commentary on the Cash for Kids, that this Cash for Kids is a glaring example of the problem with the courts being so insular. Hmm. That, you know, it's, yes, you know, we want, again, yes, I want to believe the court, the judges, the justices, they're all doing the right thing. They're trying to do the best thing for, you know, for justice, for the legal system, and for the state. But you still need something, you still need an independent body. You still need independent oversight if not just for the confidence in having the court system. And I think Cash for Kids is really shaking people's confidence in the court system. Mm.
You also write, Peter, about scoring very low on lobbying, as Delaware did as well, that was one of the key problems. But yet your report also suggests that there's a little bit of progress there.
Yeah, it took them years just to get the lobbyist disclosure reports. And I covered that when they were going through that. And I remember talking to some lawmakers and their staff, you know, why is it so difficult? And they said, well, we're trying to reach a balance, you know, because don't forget, the lobbyists have a right to petition their government like everybody else does. And we want to regulate this, but we don't want to, you know, penalize the lobbyists. And, you know, we now know how many lobbyists are lobbying the legislature, how much they're spending, how much in aggregate they're spending. I think it was a figure a couple years ago of like $80-85 million a year by all the lobbyists together, you know, spending on lobbying efforts. I think we should regulate it, and I think they're moving toward that. But covering the legislature and covering, you know, talking to lobbyists and watching the process, and I think we need to regulate the lobbyists. But in the end, it's up to the lawmakers to say no. I don't want that money. You know, it's up to them not to corrupt themselves. You know, and I don't see how much we can regulate it a lot, and I'm not sure how much regulation is really going to deter that, because I think if somebody wants to get corrupted, they're going to get corrupted. Yeah. You know, I talked to lawmakers who regularly met with lobbyists but never took anything, and they said they know things I don't know. I need to understand what their industries are about, what's going on. And I don't need to take their gifts, I don't need to take their handouts, and I don't. But I still will let them come in here and talk to me about what they're doing. You know, others, you know, it was other lawmakers, of course, I'm sure. I mean, the other problem was, and same as in Delaware, is lawmakers leaving office and then becoming lobbyists.
Yeah.
You know, and what was a bit insidious about that is that they would leave, and they had a year, I believe it's a year, or two, yeah, it's a year before they can start lobbying the legislature. Once they leave the legislature, they have a year. They can't do any lobbying in the legislature. But I would see lawmakers retire, leave office, join a lobbying firm. Then within a month, I'd see them up there, and I'd say, what are you doing? And they'd say, well, I'm just visiting old friends. Well, and how do you prove that that's not true?
Sure. Well, and it sounds very similar to what Chris Barish described in Delaware as well, that was, you know, certainly one of the big concerns. Peter, as we begin to wrap, you wrote about why Pennsylvania, of all places, in your view, needs to do better at this, being, you know, the birthplace of the nation, that there are some reasons that Pennsylvania should have scored higher in your view.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, look, we are the birthplace of democracy and this nation, and therefore, shouldn't we be the shining example of all that instead of, I mean, the bonus gate continues to go on. We, sentencing, I think, is next week for former Speaker of the House, John Purcell. I mean, it's there's been so much corruption in the state and convictions that get national attention. You have to wonder, I mean, you know, shouldn't we be aspiring to something a lot better than what we are doing right now?
So what are you hoping, Peter, will be the result of this report, this investigation that you and your colleagues have done? What would you like to see come out of it?
Well, Tracy, I'd like to see, like anybody else, good things come out of it, more openness in government, maybe give some of these agencies that have oversight, like the Office of Open Records, the Ethics Commission, more money, more funding, more resources to do their job. The cynic in me tells me that you know, that's not going to happen. I mean, I like to see this at least stir voters more than anybody else, because in the end, until voters start really reacting, they're not going to move much.
Well, Peter, we want to thank you so much for the work that you have done on this project, you and many of your colleagues as well, that has really given us much greater insight into how things work in state government and what needs to be changed, what they're doing well. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Tracy.
And we want to remind you that WHYY is a partner in this effort, the State Integrity Investigation. You can see the report on newsworks.org, and you can see how your particular state ranked and what some of the biggest concerns were there, and also, again, the areas that they have done well. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moskowain, and you're listening to Radio Times on WHYY.